All right, if you have a Bible, we're just going to look. I just want to look at one quick verse. So here's the downside for you when we have a lot of coming and going. We were doing a whole series on parables, and so it was fairly systematic walking through. Now we're just sort of doing some one-offs, which means it's whatever is in my head. So buckle up. We're going to look at John 10, and I just want to look at one verse. It's this verse 10. So Jesus speaking, he says, I have come that they, speaking of people, may have life and have it to the full. Jesus says, I have come that they may have life and have it to the full. So one of my favorite movies, and I haven't watched it in a long time, is The Princess Bride. Everybody know The Princess Bride? Get it. There's so many great parts in that movie, but one of them that I was reminded of this week is, help me with the names here. It's been a long time since I've seen it, but I think his name is like Vasily. Is it something like that? Vasily? Okay, he's the short little dude who's like the leader of the gang, and they kidnap, what's that? That's where I'm headed. So he kidnaps Buttercup, right? And he's being pursued by the hero. And along the way, he keeps thinking, you know, we've lost him this time. There's no way he'll catch up with us this time or whatever. And every time, of course, the hero stays right with him, he turns around and says, inconceivable. How does he say? Inconceivable? Do they have a lisp? Inconceivable. I was doing a wedding a few years ago, and the groom was seriously like, you have to say wuv, twu wuv. And I was like, no, because the bride, who this is actually about, is not gonna be cool with that. So, so he keeps saying inconceivable until finally, Mandy Patinkin, the great actor, is speaking. He's Inigo Montoya says, "This word you keep using. I do not think it means what you think it means." So this morning, I want to talk about something, and it's not a word. It's a concept. It's a thought. It's a an idea, almost a sense, that is so prevalent in our society it almost goes without notice. It is one that is in our music, it's in our movies, it's in our advertisements, it's in our literature, it's in everything. Okay, it's in the air that we breathe. And in fact, I was watching, I saw a movie trailer this week. So anybody watch This Is Us? This Is Us, a couple of people, not many people, okay. So the one person who watches it, the makers of are making a movie called Life Itself. I saw the trailer for this. You've already seen it. And in this movie, it carries this sense throughout. And it's summed up in this one sentence spoken by this little girl, ironically to Mandy Patinkin, coming back around full circle. And this little girl, and she says, I want a full, rich life. And even in the trailer, there's this sense of which, while we desire that, it doesn't always mean what we think it means. So Jesus, he says something very similar here. He says, I've come that they would have life. And in the NIV, it says life to the full. There's other translations that speak of the abundant life. But you could say it's a rich, full life. That's what he's come to give us, a rich, full life. To which, in one sense, we all go, yeah, man, I want that. Yeah, that's what I'm desiring. That's what we should all want. That's what life should be like. And even if we can't articulate it, it's sort of like we grasp it. We know it when we see it. But does it, when we think of that, when we imagine that, does it mean what we think it means? And the reason I think this matters is because whatever you imagine, when you imagine the rich, full life, is going to direct your life. It's going to influence how you make decisions, how you raise your kids. It's going to influence how you direct your life and what you work towards and what you dream of and all the rest. Okay. So whatever you imagine, when you imagine a rich, full life, whatever comes into your head, that is going to shape you and direct you. And if you're thinking, well, okay, Lucas, you're such a philosopher. That's so abstract. I mean, consider a couple of things. One is that what we believe directs our lives more than what we know. So I'm going to make a distinction there, that what we know, oftentimes I know, but I ignore. I can know things, but it doesn't change my behavior. It doesn't change the way that I live. I know that too much sugar is not good for me. I still like Oreos. Okay. But what I believe, that is what directs my life. And by the way, if you want to know what you believe, look at how you're living your life and do the math. Okay. Secondly, so that's number one. Number two, it seems likely to me that there's nothing more natural than that the values of our culture would begin to affect how we imagine the rich and full life. So again, if it is prevalent within our movies and our culture and everyone has this sense, then surely as I'm watching those, as I'm ingesting those, then that is in some way shaping and reshaping and defining how I too view those things, which has a lot of implications for how that I'm living. But right with that is this, that it's likely, and I would say even probable, that how we have those sense, what we imagine, is not the same for everybody. So I can watch a movie that has that sense of desiring the rich and full life, but the way they define that is very different from the way that I would define it. And even within the church, that how we might articulate it or how we imagine it, how we dream of the rich and full life actually could vary pretty significantly from person to person. And that has a pretty significant implication because imagine that you're on a team and you're part of a multi-person team and you're told as a team, if you win, you get accolades, you get the prize, you know, you've won, you know, the World Cup, okay? It's happening right now. I guarantee there are people watching it, not here this morning. I know some of them. Oh, goodness. Anyway, all right. My son asked if we could stay home and watch the World Cup. I said no. I understand. It's a big deal. All right. So if you win, you get all of that. But everyone has a different idea of not only how to win, but also how the score is being kept. So I think we win if we score enough goals, but you think we win if we, you know, everybody stays on this side of the line the longest. Or this person thinks they win if they knock enough other players down. Or this person thinks they win if no one ever gets penalized. So everybody's working towards a different definition of even how the score is being kept. And if within the church, if we have as many different views of what the rich, full life is, then it seems to me that it's likely that we all are kind of running in different directions instead of as the singular body of Christ. Does that make sense? Okay. So let's talk about this a little bit. What is fullness of life? How are we gonna unpack that a little bit? I'm glad that Randy Hoyt is here because I'm going to talk about Aristotle and he can correct me later. So Aristotle gives us, he's kind of a sharp guy. He's writing quite a while ago, around the 4th century BC. And Aristotle is ends up being incredibly influential within the Christian church. And you see this in Thomas Aquinas, is kind of one of the first people to take Aristotle's philosophy and begin to, in a sense, Christianize it, okay? But I think Aristotle, and there's a reason for that, I think Aristotle gives us some helpful frameworks for thinking through a lot of different things, but let me give you just how I think it fits into our conversation for this morning. Aristotle wrote this series of books called the Nicomachean Ethics, and it was a series of books that were intended to explain what is, and he's going to use this word, happiness. How do we gain happiness? And it comes from this Greek term, eudaimonia, and this word is often translated happiness, but in the sense it carries more of this idea of human flourishing. Okay, so it's a much fuller, richer, more robust term than simply happiness. And so for Aristotle, and again, there's a lot of complexity to this, and you can read all the different books, you know, that make up this work. But I'm going to try to simplify it just a little bit. Actually, I'm going to simplify it a ton and hopefully not lose the heart of it. For Aristotle, this sense of human flourishing is not something that you get directly, but instead it is, in a sense, like a product of what he will call the virtuous life. Okay? So for Aristotle, I don't seek happiness. I don't go and grab it. It's not something I purchase or I consume so much as it is something that I experience as I live the virtuous life. And by that he means as I'm practicing virtue. And so think of it as like showing compassion to other people, being generous, being honest, being a good friend. In fact, Aristotle, a huge portion of his ethics has to do with being a good friend. So all of those things that we might say, well, that entails, you know, virtue, as I practice those habits of virtue, that then I become a virtuous person. This shapes my character. And as I am a virtuous person, then I experience human flourishing. I experience happiness. So by that definition, or by that description, so help me out here, where does the happiness lie? Where's that coming from? Where's that human flourishing? Is it inside or outside of me? Yeah, inside. So think of it this way. If this has to do with my character and my being a virtuous person, does it matter what my circumstances are? No, it's how I respond to my circumstances, to what is happening around me. And in that, I then, even in hard times, as I am living this virtuous life, I'm experiencing human flourishing. It's the idea of a life well lived. Okay, Randy, how am I doing? That not terrible? Okay. All right. You do need money, but yeah, so there's things that you need. And he'll say that there's different virtues that are of higher importance than other virtues, but in general there's this sense of you want to live the virtuous life. It's the life well lived. Almost like in Hebrew terms, we might say this is shalom. Like this is, that would be sort of an exterior of everything. But it's like this balanced life, okay? And so for Aristotle, this is something that is within myself, in the sense that as I am a virtuous and have character, a virtuous person with character, then whatever's happening around me, I live and I respond virtuously, and I experience human flourishing as such. Okay, now there's a couple of things that I think this is where this is helpful for us. For Aristotle, you need two things. You got to have knowledge and you have to have action. Okay, so I have to understand something that's very, very profound. And that is that I cannot, so this is Aristotle here. I cannot as a person aim for happiness. Right? I can't get at that. That's the wrong way of trying to get happiness. Instead, what I have to do is I have to seek to become virtuous. And then happiness, in a sense, gets thrown in. Okay, it's a product of, in some sense. No? Something different? Okay, all right, good. Okay. So I have to know that. And so understand what I also know. I also know that happiness directly, anything that promises me happiness directly, is a lie. Okay, like that's impossible. So if all the advertisements are telling me that, you know, I need this car, I need this house, or I need this perfume, or I have to do this or that, or whatever. Whatever is telling me this is how you attain happiness, I know, well, that's not right. Because I can't get happiness directly. Okay, so let's contrast this with what I'm going to call, we'll just say like American culture happiness. Okay, so rich, full life according to the American dream. So how would we define or describe the rich, full life in our culture? How would you describe that? What's that? White picket fence, yeah. Okay. Homeownership. That, yeah, there's both of those. That's very, very deeply embedded in how we have shaped our economy, correct? Okay, so home ownership, yeah. I love it. Retirement. So there's financial. That's an I. Financial security or something. Yeah, so there's materialism, but what else? Yeah, comfort. But there's other stuff too. There's other stuff too. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's true. Fame, celebrity. What's that? Sorry, what? Well-behaved kids. I like that. Yeah, I'm going for that one. Yeah, so in some sense, it's just happiness. Whatever it is for you, in some sense. Yeah. Well-behaved kids, what I heard, marriage. Yeah, there's good things here, right? I mean, you got family, right? If you ask somebody, I think if you ask most people and just said, okay, you want to have a rich and full life, well, like, what does that mean? Like, in some ways, I don't know how quickly they run to some of these things. I tend to think that there's a lot of people who would say, well, it's friends. It's friendship. It's meaning and purpose. It's family. And then maybe what happens is they go, but the way I get it is up here, right? There's the way that I experience meaning and purpose is I have to have the right job and be successful or so on. Or maybe it just gets hijacked along the way. You know, I don't know. Okay. So how do you get these? Sorry, what? Yeah, money, I'll cut to the chase. So I think one of the significant distinctions between these two is that this one, Aristotle's approach is that I aim to be virtuous and I get happiness thrown in. Here it is, and this is to Christina's point, I just seek happiness. It's direct. I go and I buy the house. Even love, think about it. I will find that right person. It's not about being the right person, it's about finding the right person. These are all, if Aristotle, it is inside me, American Dream is outside me. And so I aim for it directly. By the way, what virtues do we need to seek happiness directly? Contentment?
Are you talking about the American Dream?
Yeah, for the American Dream. If I need the American Dream, and what virtue do I need?
Work.
Yeah, so there's a work ethic.
Determination.
Determination. There's some good ones.
Aspiration.
Okay, what else? What's that? Independence. Yeah, there's a lot of really good virtues that get wrapped up into it. What are the two most significant virtues in society, though, if you were to nail it down today, what's that? Patience. Yeah, these are good. Why? Yeah. So I need freedom. Why do I need freedom, though? So yeah, it's rooted back in the very heart of it. But why do I need freedom? If I'm pursuing happiness, and you're pursuing happiness,
I get mine before you get yours, or you don't get my way.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a pursuit of all costs. So what I have to have, instead of seeking to be virtuous here, I've got a few virtues that I need, and there's a lot of good ones. But the ones that people will fight you over, right, the ones that are getting really, really stirred up in society today are freedom, autonomy, tolerance, because if my greatest good, the rich and full life, is happiness, then I should be allowed to pursue that at all costs, however I define that. And so I have to have freedom and tolerance and autonomy for that to be possible. Does that make sense? And so we have these virtues, but they are a means to an end to happiness. Okay. So let's talk about Jesus. So pretty safe to say that, whoops, I'm skipping ahead here. Nope, my notes are just out of order. That's what it is. Pretty safe to say that Jesus is not envisioning the American dream when he talks about life to the fullest, okay? So feel pretty good about that. So how is where do I want to start here? Because I got 2 points. Which one do I want to take first? Let's start with this one. Jesus, when Jesus talks about the full life, how do we get it? How do we get life? Where does it come by? Yeah, it comes through him. Okay, so he is the way. Okay, set that aside for a second. We're going to get back to that. That's totally true. That's really important. Not just saying we're not ready for that yet. Does Jesus say that we get life directly? Think back for a second. Think about the Gospels. Think about what you know about Jesus. Now, what does he say?
You have to go through me to get life.
Yeah, you have to go through him. But he says something, again, you're... Alan, I'm not there yet, okay? Gosh, all right. Yeah, yeah. What? There's like some verses that say something along those lines. Yeah, so there's this one that he says, you got to pick up your cross and follow me, right? There's another one, where is it? Mark 8, for whoever wants to save his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for me and for the gospel will save it. Jesus is not echoing Aristotle, on a side note. So, but he's not. Aristotle was on the right track, I think, because what Jesus says when he speaks of this life that he has come to give, he doesn't say you can go get it directly. In fact, rather paradoxically, he says if you aim at life, you won't get it. If you want life, what does he say? If you want to save your life, you'll lose it. Whoever loses his life for me will save it. So Jesus, I need to put Jesus up here, okay? But he's saying something very similar here, but instead of saying you're aiming at virtue, right? Let's get Jesus here. Right? We're aiming at him. And the way that we, right, there's this whole follow his example, die to self. Your life becomes about him, and in that, you get happiness thrown in. I like Chesterton. He has speaking about something a little bit different, but he says you have to desire life like water, but drink death like wine. And his point being that you have to get to the life, you have to accept the death that Jesus died. If you want to live, you've got to die. But okay, let's think about this for a second. Does God desire these things for us? Yeah, okay, so explain. Yes and no.
Well, if God knows you can handle the wealth, because you have life and you're experiencing more abundance, then that typically comes because you saw him first and you gave him his reward. But on the other hand, if you're seeking the reward for him, you may not get that. Or you might get that and see that it's completely, utterly useless because you never went to him to get the life.
Okay.
Experience that.
Okay.
I think it's to have everything that we desire with a balance of knowing that there are certain requirements and responsibility of you to accept what you want and follow him.
Okay.
First.
Okay. Okay.
I've been through it.
Okay.
I guess I need to backtrack here for a second. Because Jesus said over and over again how hard it was for a rich man to get eternal life.
Yeah.
So there's a danger in having all that.
Yeah, definitely danger there. Christina. Okay. Okay.
All right. I don't think God promises any of that. I think he delights in us and he gives us blessings.
Yeah.
He, first and foremost, wants us to know him and to make him known, glorify him.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean that I will have, I may live a life of poverty, but out of joy serving my Lord on the journey he's called me to.
Uh-huh.
He calls us all on a different journey.
Okay. Okay, so, do you think that which one of these? Best characterizes. We're going to be a little cynical here, but we're going to pull it out. Okay, we're going to be a little cynical, but then we're going to pull it out. Right, we're going to start cynical. Which one of these would you say best characterizes the American church today? Being a little cynical here.
You're right. That's it.
This one. So I've only got two up here. I've given up on Aristotle. Aristotle's gone. Okay, we got Jesus, and we got sort of the American. Okay, so. Is it fair to say, in one sense, actually, I'm not going to go there. Okay, so let's be a little cynical. All right, so this kind of characterizes it. Now, why? Here's what I don't know how to get there, so I'm just going to, let me just pull this out for a second. I don't think this is all bad. There's a temptation to go, oh my gosh, look at the church, it's looking for all these things. I think that God does desire all of these things for us. I think that God desires everything that we could, whatever you're imagining for the rich, full life, okay, with one very, 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 very important caveat. It is understood through the lens of the kingdom. Okay? And by that, here's what I mean. It means two things. One is it changes my understanding of some of these things. Okay? So for example, I desire financial security. Okay, let's look at that through the lens of the kingdom. But here's how I mean that. It's going to change the way that I understand these things, but it is in light of the eternal kingdom. Okay? Where I think we get off track, especially in our American society, is that we are looking for the kingdom before it gets here. This is what we call an overrealized eschatology. This is one of the chief criticisms of what we call the prosperity gospel. That basically it's saying, you get the kingdom now. So if I'm faithful to God, I get the kingdom now. If I am, you know, have enough faith, and by the way, that is demonstrated often by giving enough money to the person who's preaching. Speaking of being cynical. Then you get the kingdom now. But there's a problem that I don't get the kingdom now. There's something else that comes before the kingdom. What is it? Oh, yeah, this. That's what this life is about here. So in a sense, everything that I dream of, that my heart, even if I can't articulate it, that I know it when I see it, everything that I could put on that list in some way is fulfilled in the kingdom. I mean, even home ownership. Hey, look at that. Get mansions. Okay. So everything is being realized. I mean, family, friends, all of these things are realized within the kingdom. It's not going to look exactly the way that it looks now. It's in through the lens of the kingdom, but it also isn't now, it's then. It is to come. And so I'm not looking for these things now. Now is the time when we die to self and we look forward to ultimately the kingdom as it comes. So flourishing in that sense doesn't mean what we think it means. It's a hint of. And that's what we get in this life, right? We get hints of the kingdom. It's like when you're sitting down with friends and you just have one of those conversations, one of those moments, and everybody's laughing and you're just having a good time. And you know what I'm talking about. It's like just one of those moments you go, this is rich. This is awesome. But it doesn't last very long, right? Then everybody goes home and you've got life and everything else. But that was a little taste of the kingdom, right? Those moments when you're sitting down with, you know, your spouse or with a parent who you're super close to or your best friend, and it's one of those moments, or a sunset, it's giving you a picture of, but it's not yet. It's not yet. So we get off track because there's something that comes before the kingdom, and that is death, and that's what Jesus tells us. So here's how this plays out practically, by the way. If I try to seek this directly, what everything in culture shows us is it doesn't work. And we all know this. So if I think about, in for example, a marriage relationship, if I seek my happiness in my marriage, first and foremost, do I get a happy marriage? No. Anybody get married and discover how selfish you are?
Yeah.
Right? And it's like, oh, that guy. Yeah. Okay. So what happens is you realize, okay, when I go into this marriage and I'm seeking for myself, then it ends very badly. But if I seek the good and the happiness and the joy of the other person, then you get a happy marriage. If I had gone into it going, all right, Carrie, you're going to do all the dishes. I'm never going to have to lift a finger. I'm never going to have to do this. I'm never going to do this. By the way, I knew a guy who told his wife when they moved into a new house, and she was like showing him the house, and she was like, and here's like the laundry room or something. And he was like, why are you showing that to me? I will never be in there. I was like, bold move. He's still alive. Remarkable. He's still married. He was from another generation. I'm giving that a little bit of maybe, like a little of that, but not much. Let's be honest. Okay. I did not try that. When we moved in our first apartment, it was behind a door. It was like laundry room. There they are. Clothes, you know. And by the way, that was the kitchen too. All right. So C.S. Lewis, he puts it this way. In Mere Christianity, he says, look for yourself and you will find in the long run only hatred, loneliness, despair, rage, ruin, and decay. But look for Christ and you will find him, and with him everything else thrown in. So we look to Jesus, we die to self, and we get happiness thrown in. All right. So we have two problems that we're left with. Two problems. One is society's problem. This is where I want to go. Society has a problem. Maybe you've seen it. There are contradictory values that are being constantly pushed, and they don't work very well together. That's why they're contradictory. The first one is this, and this is where we started. It's the pirate's mantra, take all you can, give nothing back. That's the first one. You will seek happiness at all costs. No one should get in your way. Destroy anything that comes between you and what you desire. That is value number one. And value two, and this is fascinating, is love others. Wait. So, you know, pillage and destroy for whatever will make you happy, but then show compassion. So which is it? How do we do that? How do we solve this contradiction? So how does society try to solve, how do we do this within our culture?
Love.
Yeah, so we want to love other people, but I'm also supposed to love.
We don't have that going on right now, especially in light of our current events.
That's true. There's very little love on the horizon at the moment, yeah.
Or even, you know, patience.
Yeah.
Where people come forward and accept, you know, is the differences.
Yeah.
I had an amazing experience. May I share that?
Sure.
From yesterday?
Yeah.
I was at the pool, and a little couple, a gal came in, and there was sitting a lady, and I thought maybe she had a stroke or cancer, because her head was, you know, maybe a half an inch of hair.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, hi. And she automatically went like this.
Hmm.
And I'm very friendly, as you can tell. I'm a type A, Leo.
There you go.
Whatever that means.
I have
and
no
so
idea.
Anyway, the girl came and she talked to her, and I thought it was her mom because they almost look similar. Then her husband came to find out after talking to them that they're going to a Christian college in Waco, which was a cool thing. And I said, so, is your mom okay? And she says, that's not my mom. And I said, wow, what is she? And she said, we picked her up at Sonic.
Oh, wow.
She's homeless.
Hmm.
And I've never done that.
Yeah.
So my heart filled with love for her.
Hmm.
Because I saw her fear and her trepidation even speaking to her.
Hmm.
So we talked a little bit more. I don't know if she's mentally ill or she had such trauma to her. And she came out a little bit, and so I said, come up here and sit down at the gazebo. I have some fruit. No, I'm fine. I said, no, come to the gazebo, I'm going to do something. I want to talk to you, I want to find out more about you. And so we did, and I said, I am going to go get you a plate of food, just real simple, turkey meat, cheese, some more grapes, and bring you a cold water. Does that sound good? We were going to bring her today. She took off.
Oh, no.
And she's a professor. She said she was a professor and a New York Times writer. And the couple are going to come to church. I've already invited a few people to church.
Oh, that's great.
And they've been going to what's it called, Grace? And I'm here, Gateway.
Okay.
I'm at Elevate. And I've
kind of been different places, yeah.
I've hit the whole gamut here.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I'm hoping, I went to the pool area. She wasn't there. Her plate of food was left on the counter in her bottle or her water from Sonic. But she took my bottle.
Okay.
She did eat.
Good.
And I felt so much love for this woman. It was overwhelming. And I've never done that. I give
That's
money
cool.
sometimes
yeah,
to
yeah.
the homeless.
Yeah.
But not a lot, because you never know what they're going to do with it.
Yeah.
They say. But that's love. To
yeah,
me,
absolutely.
Love.
Yep.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you. So we have a, you know, so I guess my question would be, what motivates that apart from Christ? So if you've got these within culture, you have take everything that you can. You have to get your happiness. Your happiness is what's most important. But also, we're being told to love other people. So what motivates that? How do we solve this? Is there a solution to this?
I think part of it is I give you freedom, and that's what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
I give you the same freedom that I have.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna hold you back.
Yeah.
So that's part. I know there's more than two than that, but
yeah.
That's part of it.
Yeah. So. Let's not dwell on this. I think that let's get to the Christian solution to this, which is what we've already been talking about. But I think within culture, what you'll often hear is, well, there's a sense of working for the common good. That's probably the most common expression that I've heard of it. So I'm not going to do anything to prevent your freedom, as James said, and I am allowed to pursue my freedom up to the point that is affecting the common good. Up to the point that, and I'm going to define that as it limits other people's freedom. Anything that harms other person's freedom, inhibits their freedom, that's where we draw the line. Okay. There's some serious limitations to that, but we're running out of time, so I just have to keep going. What I think is beautiful about Christianity, and why I think that this is I'm very confident this is the best solution, is that if I'm forced to choose between your happiness and mine, and we're both, so your happiness, right? I have to choose. I've got to choose one or the other. Which is it going to be? And I may have some different criteria for how I work out that equation. It may be right. But Jesus offers a different way, because if I'm not aimed at my own happiness, then what I'm doing is I'm seeking the good of others, and I get happiness thrown in. That what Jesus is calling us to, and what Christianity calls us to, is to love others, to seek the flourishing and the good of other people, and it's not at odds with my own, because my own is yet to come. Remember, my own is what is out in the future. It's when the kingdom comes. But in the meantime, I experience flourishing as it is defined and understood in this life, which is looking forward to the next one. Does that make sense? Okay, Janae.
Yeah, I think it's a very clear imperative that also is very hard to accept in Philippians 2, where he says you consider others more important.
Right, Philippians 2, yeah.
And we tend to want to say, like, do unto others as you have in your like that kind of concept of let's keep it equal, but that's not what Christ is. Incredibly challenging to us on an everyday way of living life, especially in a country where that's not at all the mindset, generally speaking.
Correct, yeah. I mean, we're left with, you need to choose between one or the other. And so your happiness is at conflict with mine. And so which am I going to do? Which one wins this time versus that time? But through what Christ is telling us is, well, I can always seek your good, and it's not in conflict with mine. Me seeking your flourishing actually is, I'm not doing it for my flourishing, but it gets thrown in. I get to experience that, because that is how God is shaping my character. And in that, I'm actually experiencing, I'm getting a taste of the kingdom that is to come, when everything that I'm looking for and longing for will finally come to fruition. So the church's problem is this, that it is very, very easy, as Janae said, to have a almost replacement theology when it comes to the gospel. That it's easy to replace the Christian gospel with an Americanized version of the gospel. And so we have taken this And in many ways, we've adopted this equation wholeheartedly. And I see this in my own life, where it becomes, well, do I do this for this person, but what about me? Right? It becomes an either or. And so, as the church, we're being called to be different, to define flourishing differently, to seek flourishing differently. And what does it look like? From an American culture perspective, understand it looks, frankly, like death. That's what it looks like, death. I mean, if you watch someone who is living for somebody else and is generous beyond what you can understand, I mean, it looks like you're giving away all of this. You're letting go of all this. That sounds like death. But in fact, it is where we find, it's where we find life. I wrote down just off the top of my head, I was sort of brainstorming, like, what would flourishing look like as believers? What would flourishing look like? Because it sounds so, I want us to get a sense of just how countercultural this idea is. And so maybe this will be helpful, but this is what I wrote down. Flourishing looks like finding contentment in enough so that others may have what they need. It looks like being willing to suffer embarrassment, even loss, for the sake of the gospel which others need. It means living out what I believe in front of my kids. So, in other words, if I am telling my children that flourishing is not found in material things, then am I pursuing material things? It's not about toys, I say, as I collect as many toys as possible. It's about loving other people, I say, as I never demonstrate loving other people in front of my kids. So it's living that out. It looks like putting others ahead of ourselves and considering their interests above our own, Philippians 2. It looks like putting aside my right to privilege, power, and prestige for the sake of someone else's good. It looks like loving God and seeking heaven above my little kingdom here on earth. It looks like showing compassion even to my enemies. It looks like forgiving all, everyone, even those who hate me or hurt me. It looks like inexplicable grace and love. It looks like rejecting the language of those people and instead embracing an uncommon empathy for all people. It looks like humbly believing the best of others and respecting their perspectives while regarding my own views with a healthy skepticism. It looks like weighing my politics on the scale of the Christian gospel. It looks like honestly evaluating my opinions and views and prejudices to see where they must be recalibrated to line up with God's economy of justice, even at the cost of my own ideologies. It looks like redefining freedom, not as freedom to pursue my own happiness, but as freedom to lay down my life for the blessing of others. Sounds like death. Sounds like death. So, final thing, final thought. If with Aristotle it was inside of me, with the American dream it's outside of me to pursue, what we believe as Christians is, and we're going all the way back to the beginning, you guys were way ahead, life isn't found within me. And it's not found outside of me in the good gifts that God gives. It is found in Christ and in Christ alone, which means that it's not even through self-sacrifice or serving other people that I receive life. Like, it is wholly other than me. It is Christ living through me. I find my life in Him. He says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And this is where Jesus is, as always, completely unique. Because it's not about me trying to seek happiness directly and gaining this life that I long for. And it's not about looking inside of me and finding the happiness that I long for, even in being a good, virtuous person. It is ultimately about finding my life only in Him and looking to Him and following His example. And in that, there is a, I get to taste the kingdom. I get to taste a little bit of this flourishing. All of which to say that we cannot create, I cannot create my best life now. It's yet to come. Andy.
I think this is where, from my very limited experience, I mean, in theory, yes, I agree with everything.
Yeah.
But this is where the church stops. It's like once you get them in the door, you're kind of on your own. you're at work, you have your family, you pay your bills.
Yeah.
Monday through Friday. This is where I think the universal church struggles,
especially
which
the big ones.
Is, let me come alongside you and show you what that living in Christ
looks like.
We have been blessed by friends that have modeled that for us.
Mm-hmm.
We still struggle with, okay, how do we do that? Not just with our kids, that's a given.
Yeah.
But with
yeah.
other people that we know.
Yeah.
And
like, how do you model it for them, or how do you, is that what you're asking?
Just, I think it was you that mentioned it, because you don't hear this word very often, which is discipling.
Yeah.
To me, which is, whoever it is that the Lord puts in your path,
mm-hmm.
that obviously has a need, whether it's physical or spiritual, it all comes down to spiritual. But I think where we struggle, where the church in general struggles, is, okay, now that you believe in Jesus, what do you do with that? What does that look like in an everyday setting?
Mm-hmm.
What does that look like a year from now? How do we get to that point? That whole discipling concept,
mm-hmm.
I think we are very weak in.
Yeah, I agree.
We are fairly new to grace, so maybe it's different here. But with our experience in other churches, that is sorely lacking.
Yeah, yeah.
And we hunger for that.
Yeah.
We hunger for community
mm-hmm.
that gets that.
Yeah. I think that I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think that the danger of churches when you're in a society that is, it's easy to be a Christian. It's easy to say that you're a Christian. And because we have adopted a twisted version of the gospel where it's, I'm choosing happiness, and that just sort of works. And we can make that work. And I think within churches, it's much easier to talk about these things and to know these things than to believe these things. And just speaking for my own life, so this is, I don't know how well Grace does it compared to other churches. I mean, in some ways it's hard for me to even speak to that. I know what we desire to do, which is to get better at building community. You know, I said this last week, you know, one of our strengths is content. We teach well, we got Bible, we got theology, and then, you're right, there's a weakness to that as well, that if it never goes beyond that, then what good is that? For my own life, I would say that it is about two things that I personally can take responsibility for, and that is, one is having people in my life and seeking those people out and trying to be as intentional as possible. And sometimes the church is helpful with that. You know, what we're trying to do, or what I hope we can do, is create some opportunities for relationships to be built. And then that's an organic thing. At that point, it's like you're getting to know somebody. It's also an intentional thing of, hey, let's do life together. Let's walk through this. And how are we handling these things? How are we answering these big questions? I think the other thing, though, is, you know, if it comes down to belief, well, what is belief? It's faith. So how do I grow my faith? I don't know about you. The best way I found to grow my faith is to jump in the deep end. Every time I've come to a decision in my life where it's like, okay, I could do this or I could do this, what Carrie and I have talked about so many times is, okay, well, which one is going to put us in a position to trust God more? Well, if I got nothing else, that's a great place to start. So, I mean, for me, and this is not a, you know, understand how I take this, but for whatever reason, this was just God, I really believe God was pushing in my heart in this way. This wasn't me being genius. When I was getting out of college, one, it helps when you major in philosophy, so you have no prospects. So that was really advantageous. It was like, go to law school or drive a cab, you know, so Starbucks, that was about it. So, but I had a profound moment where I was like, okay, I can do these things, or I had this opportunity. It wasn't even offered to me. I sought an opportunity where I would grow in my faith. And that was to, you know, for me, it was to join crew and to move overseas. That's a bit dramatic, I understand. But for me, it just came down to, if I do this, I don't know if I'll grow in my faith. This, I know I'm going to grow in my faith, so I'm going to do that. And where I've seen people take the biggest steps in their faith, where they've grown the most, and they have become people who have died to themselves, is when they've said, okay, this makes no sense, but I know this will put us in a position. We're going to dive into the deep end. I know this will put me in a position where I have no choice but to rely on the Lord. And so I'm going to, we've got friends right now who are, you know, they're doing house studies so they can become foster parents. And they've got three kids, I think, three little kids. I mean, they're a lot younger than ours. And they're like, you know, this is crazy. We have a crazy life. It makes no sense. But man, is this going to put us in a position to trust Jesus and also to love others? I'm going to do that. So that's just one example. I'm going to dive into the deep end. I'm pretty convinced that the reason that the church is as stagnant as it is because we are not we're not forced to grow. And then on the other side of that is we're cowards, just to be really blunt. So. You know, somebody, who was this, Chuck, who, you know, they said the history of Christianity is basically people trying to get out of the Sermon on the Mount. Like, that's the history of Christianity, is the church running in the opposite direction, trying to find a way around it. And I think that there's a lot of truth to that. We have to dive in the deep end. Yeah, Janae.
I know this all the time. Everything you said, 100% ditto. The only thing I would add to that is we tend to talk about the church isn't as a union, but we are the church.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah.
As well, like finding a way to serve and a way to serve, adding one more way to serve in my faith that I don't think I have time for, and that's usually where the relationships are fostered.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do your thing.
Yep. Cool.
How many times more that is when you have to sleep on the
here?
There's been nothing but this. It was the first time that we were both actually. And that was a big thing. Our previous church, they very much focused on outreach. They were big, getting the t-shirts.
Right.
But then it was
more
at church. Right. But we also weren't asking. We reached Grace Bible at a breaking point that we kind of were like, hey, that we'd like some help. And it was nothing but this.
Yeah, Alan, last word.
So
go.
Those of you who remember the Penningtons,
yeah,
been going for a while.
Yeah, Mike and Krista.
They still talk about things that are done here that isn't done anywhere else.
Hmm.
And it's sad to say, but a lot of churches don't have a lot of outreaches like this church does.
Hmm.
There's places to get involved. You can get to know people.
Yeah.
And a lot of places don't do that at all or don't do it very well. One of their main complaints about all the other churches around where they moved to is that there's really no involvement outside of the service or some of the small group.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. So different churches, you know, have different strengths, weaknesses. We certainly didn't do everything great. We're trying to get better, but at the end of the day, you know, we're each one of us, to Janae's point, we're all responsible for our own growth. All right, we got to wrap up.